Lowe's knows how to get you ready for holiday hosting with up to 35% off select home decor. And get up to 35% off select major appliances. Plus, members get free delivery, haulaway, basic installation, parts, and a 2-year Lowe's protection plan when you spend $2,500 or more on select LG major appliances. Valid through 10-1. Member offer excludes Massachusetts, Maryland, Wisconsin, New Jersey, and Florida. Installed by independent contractors. Exclusions apply. See Lowe's.com for more details.
Hello and welcome. You're tuned into the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, along with me, Tim Dennis. Tim, you know, I love when we hear from our listeners. We hear from people all around the world with different thoughts and ideas regarding our show, topics, and conversations that we have. And we've had a really great chance over the last few months of talking to individuals that don't have books out, haven't been featured on programs, but have had their own strange experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we've talked about a lot of things on the show over the years, and a lot of times religion comes up in them, and especially when you're dealing with things like exorcism and possession.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that's always fascinated us is, you know, we always hear from the Christian perspective of how do they deal with the supernatural and the paranormal? How is it conceived, perceived, and dealt with? And I actually had a listener who reached out to me via social media and said, you know, why don't you ever cover other religious aspects of exorcism, possession, and the supernatural. And I said, I'd love to, but it's just finding somebody that is willing to come on and talk about that. And our guest said, well, I'm that someone. I'd be happy to join you. So joining us now on the air, Issa Martell. And just a brief bit, Issa was raised Catholic and converted to Islam back in 1996. And you've been into supernatural your whole life, Issa, is that right?
That is correct. Yes, my whole life I've been into it, and it's been something that we kind of grew up doing or investigating, and it, like you said, it's just been an interest I had going back probably like to childhood via horror movies or whatever, but I've just been fascinated with this idea of paranormal or supernatural experiences.
So it was more of an outside stimuli that got you interested in it, or did you have what you would believe to be some supernatural experiences growing up?
I think looking back, probably there were supernatural experiences, but at the time I didn't equate that to these things that were happening because just lack of awareness or anything like that. When I was a child, I remember at my grandmother's house, she had a Ouija board, and we would do things like, as me and my cousins, maybe when we were 10, that age, we would mess around with the Ouija board and stuff. And, you know, you weird things would happen that we would scare ourselves by. But at the time, you kind of like put that out of your head, like we just scared ourselves or whatever, or you're right. Questioning was that something, or, you know, that type of stuff. But nothing that I can definitely say this was some events that happened.
So nothing you could define completely as supernatural or spiritual. I'm guessing when you say you were raised Catholic, if you had a Ouija board around the house, it probably wasn't real strict Catholic upbringing then.
Well, it's ironic because, no, it wasn't. I had gone to a Catholic school. I was an altar boy and everything, but my parents were divorced. So I was raised with my mom, and the Ouija board was on my dad's side. And as I grew up, I had become, when I started to have issues with Catholicism and stuff, I became much more spiritual and investigating other religions. But I had noticed odd things at my grandmother's house, like odd events, just weird things. Like she would have dolls, a lot of dolls. She had a this weird shrine with statues of Mary and stuff in her bedroom, candles and all this. So I had always suspected that she was practicing some sort of like tribal religion. She is from Puerto Rico, but she's like indigenous Puerto Rican as opposed to someone who came from like brought over like from Spain or Africa or something like that. So I had always suspected that there were things going on, but I had never experienced something directly. Later in life, she had admitted to me that she actually practices this island religion. I guess it would be similar to like Santeria or something, and offered to try to teach it to me. But at this point, it was just I was already progressed as being, I had already converted to Islam at this point. So it was something that I was like, heck no. I don't want to learn this, something I don't really want to partake into.
Did you have a chance to really kind of sit down and talk with her about it to get an understanding and garner some information regarding her belief system and where it stemmed from? And what information did she give you?
Yeah, I was living with her for a little bit in the 90s, and she would do things that I thought was weird. Like, for example, I had a flu or something one time, and she made me some soup, and it like really made me feel good. Like basically healed the flu overnight. It seemed really weird. And I was like, what was in that soup? And she just would laugh and be like, haha, nothing. It's just my special soup or whatever. And so it was like little things like this that you would notice out the corner of your eye that most people would not suspect or anything. But after a course, I was starting to tally all these things up and be like, you know, there's something odd here. During this time in the 90s, I was kind of searching for religion, and I was the new age thing, like the new age spirituality was becoming big back then. And I had gone to a dream therapist because I was experiencing like odd dreams and stuff. And this time I was living with my grandmother. So she kind of began to notice that I was adamant about spirituality and religion, which is nobody else in my family is. So I'm really the only other person who has like a firm set religious belief. And one day she called me up and said, hey, could you come over to my house and help me move some furniture or something? And I was like, yeah, no problem. And I got there and she was acting odd in a sense that she was really friendly and being really nice. And so I'm helping her move some stuff, and she just opened up and said, I think you got this dark cloud over you, and nobody in the family knows this, but I practice this religion. She didn't term religion. She just, I don't exactly remember the wording that she said, but to paraphrase, she said that I can help you get rid of this cloud if you accumulate these like basic components, I'm going to say. One was like a bunch of gallons of holy water. I don't remember the exact specifics of what all the other details were. And she said that, I'll put you in the bathtub and basically like bathe you with this concoction and it'll get rid of this cloud. But she said the firm thing about it was that you have to believe in it 100% and allow me to do it and not talk about it amongst the family. So that point, like I said, I was already into Islam, and I was like, this is like kind of equates to magic to me. And like I was like, no, I didn't deny her initially because I didn't want to be like no and hurt her feelings, but I was like, let me think about it. And then I contacted her and called her up after a couple of days, and I was like, no, I don't think I'm gonna do that. But I mentioned it to my sister and to other people in my family, and they just like completely like don't believe it, you know, and they're like, no, she can't be like that or whatever. That's nothing. What are you talking about? So that's that. Answer your question. Yeah, that's how she explained it to me and when she explained it to me. But she has, I would say they're like voodoo dolls, you know, because they're little stuffed dolls with pins in them. And she does these things, and that's what she believes. So
is your grandmother still with us?
Yeah, she is. Yeah. And to this day, I'm from Pennsylvania, so I live now here in Minneapolis. And I told my wife about it. I was like, yo, when we go to Pennsylvania and you meet my grandmother, like, check out the couch and stuff, because she got these dolls. And even my wife didn't believe it. And so, you know, I was like, no, when you sit on the couch, there'll be this little stuffed doll and peel it up, and it'll have some pins in it. And sure enough, like, my wife sits down and, you know, there's this doll there with these pins in it. And she was kind of like, whoa, you know. But yeah, she's still with us. And we talk, like I said, she's the only other person in my family who's firm in a set of spirituality. So we'll still have really deep spiritual discussions, you know, but she is on her path and I'm on my path, and that's the way it is. But we still get along and talk and everything. So it's interesting for sure.
Do you have, you know, now being aware of that, acutely aware of your grandmother's interest in this, do you believe that, you know, maybe your interest in all of this came from her abilities, her openness to this, and kind of creating a whirlwind effect of spirituality around you that you weren't even aware of?
Yeah, looking back on it, that's, you know, a pretty acute observation that now, you know, I'm in my 40s, I would for sure think about that. And when I think about my childhood, I can't really think of any specific events, but in general, I do believe that that is a possibility. I'm the first grandchild. And so I think that all this, you know, could be possible. And I think also, perhaps, you know, maybe my whole life, she was kind of subtly feeding me keys into like supernatural or paranormal spirituality, whatever you want. Maybe perhaps with her intention to transfer this knowledge to me, because I'm the firstborn grandchild and none of my dad or his brothers, none of them, you know, accepted this. So maybe that was her plan, or still is her plan. You know, maybe she's hoping that, you know, via my wife, or she talks to my wife's kids and stuff, that will like accept this or something like that. I don't know, but I certainly think that that's a extremely high possibility for sure.
What led you, I mean, of all the possibilities of religious backgrounds, to go from Christian to the Islamic faith, what steered you into that direction?
So it was like in the 90s, so we obviously, it was a different world. 9/11 and this stuff clearly didn't happen yet. So it was, the Islam wasn't viewed as it is viewed now. So in the early 90s, I was in high school. I graduated in 92. I was on this path. I came to realize there were aspects about Catholicism that I didn't like, and not that I didn't like, I couldn't really get behind. Like, when I actually started to understand what was supposedly going on in the church and what you're supposed to believe in mass, and the clear fact is what you're believing is that the priest is turning the wine or the water into the blood of Christ and the communion into the flesh of Christ, that this was literal and not like a figuratorial thing, and then you're consuming it. This kind of like started to wake me up to like, well, what is really this? I understand by definition that is communion and stuff, but to me it sounded really, really like some tribal, or I'm going to use the word paganism, but I don't want it to be like I understand paganism is different, but I'm just using that general term. And then the thing with like the saints, and statues, like kissing statues, praying to saints as intercessions. I really couldn't, I had issues with this. And I thought that, well, if there's a God, why do I got to do all this? And why can't I just pray or communicate with God directly? So at this point in my life, I had reread the Bible from an open perspective. I also have, let me just clarify, I also began to have issues with the concept of the Trinity and Jesus being God and this triune God and the Holy Spirit. So at this point in my life, I read the Bible again with no preconceived notions and came to the conclusion after reading it that the Trinity isn't mentioned in it. The concept of a triune God isn't mentioned. And from my point of view, that if you read the Bible with the preconceived notion of God being a triune God, yes, you can plug it in and say, yeah, look, here in the Old Testament, this would be it. This would be it here. Jesus says this, blah, et cetera, et cetera. But if you don't have that conception, I don't believe you come to the end of it, to the end of the Bible, believing that. So at this point, I believed that Jesus was a prophet. I just didn't believe that he was God. And so I considered myself a Christian, but searching for some other type of spiritual belief. I then led me on the path to look more at Eastern religions like Buddhism and things like this. And coincidentally, I stumbled upon Islam. And at the time, I thought Islam was just a religion, not even a religion, more like a philosophy, like Buddhism or something like this. I was completely ignorant. I had never known a Muslim back then, and I never met one. I had no idea what Islam was. I was really initially attracted to it, I think, by the calligraphy like that was on the Quran, like the English translation, that was like the initial thing that drew it to me, you know? I was like, wow.
That might be like the strangest thing I've ever heard is what drew you to the religion is, wow, they've got very fancy handwriting. I like that about a religion.
Like, yeah, well, it looked cool, you know, like from when you're looking at like a ruin, you know what I mean? Like that type of thing. Like I was like, all right, what is this? You know, it looks exotic or it looks like old or something. So I ended up reading about it and found through my own readings and that Jesus was mentioned in the Quran in Islam. And when I read this, I initially just researched in the Quran, the translated Quran that I had come across about Jesus, and then found out that Moses and Noah and all these Old Testament prophets are also in the Quran. And so when I found out about this, I was like, well, it's incumbent upon me as someone who still believed in God, in this, you know, in the sense of a monotheistic God, a creator, and I believe that Jesus was a prophet. So if this other book is mentioning all of this stuff that I already believe in, you know, it's incumbent upon me to research it and see what they're saying. And in doing that is what ultimately led me to come to believe it, because when I read the Quran, it kind of validated the beliefs of monotheism I had, like clearly that Jesus wasn't God and that he was a messenger and a prophet, and clarified stuff about Old Testament prophets. Like I had issues with Noah being drunk and like weird incestual stories and stuff like this. And the Quran clarifies that these events didn't happen, and these people were righteous people who should be looked upon and as prophets and followed in that sense. So that's what led me down the path and, you know, started me to accept it. I kind of, when I read it, it was like I already believed this, so it was natural and easy for me to accept it and, you know, go on the path of being a Muslim.
All right. Now, I want to talk about, your journey then into the spiritualism and the supernatural side of what you were able to uncover, and how it varied between the two different religions that you've been a part of in your life. To me, that's kind of fascinating. And I know you've got a lot of weird things that have occurred, including being a part of a few exorcisms and how the Islamic faith deals with that. We'll cover that when we return right here on Beyond the Darkness. Issa Martel is our guest this afternoon as we're talking about the supernatural from a different perspective. Again, I love when people reach out to me and they want to share their insights, wisdom, and perhaps enlighten us to a totally different perspective of the supernatural. And this is interesting for me, especially, I what's intriguing to me about your story, Issa, is the fact that you have two different backgrounds. You've straddled kind of two different belief systems and have been exposed to many others. And how they might differentiate and how they might deal with these different aspects of the supernatural and paranormal are very intriguing. Had you ever looked into the Catholicism way of dealing with possession, ghosts, aliens, any of that while you were still in the Christianity vein of religious upbringing?
Yeah, it was, I did, clearly, like the movie The Exorcist, you know, was a big thing. So I viewed it basically in that type of sense, as in presented in that. With the other things such as aliens and stuff, I had difficulty then rationalizing from a Christian belief or a Catholic belief in aliens. Like, how do you rectify this with Catholicism or Christianity? How can that even aliens plug into that ideology? And this was also one of the reasons that made me kind of search for something else that would encompass all these things, because I did believe that it is possible that aliens exist, you know, and I did believe in ghosts. I did believe in these things, and I still do. So I had difficulties plugging into, okay, how is this going to fit in? You know, how would this work? What I had found from my own experience, that these things just weren't really talked about, at least back then. Maybe now they are. But back then, I couldn't find answers to that. And nobody that I knew could give me answers. And things like spirits and ghosts, if it was like a exorcist or like a seance or any kind of apparition, it was always viewed as a bad thing. And it was like a New Age or spiritualists, like the spiritualism ideology or movement that I viewed that was happening in the 90s, that kind of started to open it up to be like, it's not bad. You know, it could be a positive experience or whatever. It's not all negative and evil, you know? So, that's kind of like how, what I felt and, kind of how I viewed these things during that time period.
Let's talk about now into the Islamic faith. As you start to sink yourself into this belief system and theology of Islam, what do you notice that's so different in the difference between these two and how they look at religion, how they look at beliefs, and then dealing with the supernatural side? Did you ask your religious leaders about that, or are they just, is that part of the rhetoric and teachings?
Well, initially it is, to answer your question, yes, it is part of the teachings, but it's still, as a Westerner, as an American who converted, it's not, you still have to kind of dig for it. I guess if you were born and raised in the Middle East or in North Africa or a country that is predominantly Muslim, the culture itself has this belief ingrained in it, the belief that spirits, like, so in Islam, we believe magic exists 100%. We believe in the evil eye 100%. We believe that spirits exist. We call them jinn. I know they're back in the old radio show, you had a bunch of jinn shows. But this is right here is kind of the main difference that I noticed, and that is the viewing of what is a spirit or what is a ghost or an apparition. And from the Islamic point of view, we believe that it would be a jinn that is this apparition. To explain, a jinn is a race of beings that exist amongst us humans. So we believe in Islam that God created three races. He created the angels, the jinn, and humans. And the angels were created from light, and they don't have free will. So the angels, whatever God commands angels to do, they're going to do it. The jinn are said to be created from what is called smokeless fire. So they have free will, and they can do, you know, anything that we can do because we also have free will. And then finally, humans were created as the third race, I guess you can say. And we were created from clay and also to have free will. The jinn, to get into the spirituality aspect, the jinn would be the spirits and the world of the unseen. To compare it with Christianity, we believe in the devil. Islam also, we believe in the devil. But in Christianity, the belief is that there were the fallen angels, and Satan was the leader of the fallen angels and rebelled. But from an Islamic perspective, we don't believe that because we believe the angels don't have free will. So they could have never rebelled against God. So the devil is a jinn, and he led this group of jinn who have free will to rebel against God. When God created Adam, he told the people, the beings there, to prostrate to Adam. And the devil said, no, you created me out of fire. You created Adam out of clay. I'm superior. I've been worshiping you this whole time. And that led him to become the devil by rebelling there. So that is, from a spiritual aspect, one major difference. So with that in mind,
but what's interesting to me is I've I'm horrible with this, and I apologize to our listeners and you across the board. You know, we have such a limited scope of what we believe in, and it sounds like the Islamic belief system is kind of predicated on a basic understanding and belief in Christianity as well, just some subtle changes and differences, right?
That's correct, actually, because according to Islam, Christianity was the previous revelation before Muhammad came, you know, so it is like a continuation of the revelation.
See, and I never knew that. To me, you know, some of these other religions just seemed like you know, a completely different storyline. I didn't even realize that there was a narrative thread of Christianity that was a part of them. So this, again, and Tim, I know that you're much more open to the different religious cultures, but are you surprised to find that some of these religions that people have been so quickly, or, you know, quick to dismiss and denounce, actually have these same kind of the common threads with the religious upbringing that you and I have had?
Not a surprise, no, because I'd taken quite a few courses and taken some courses in college where you study religions as not only as literature, but you study the different threads of religions and how they're similar and different. So I'm actually quite familiar with it, but I'm not as shocked because my stepfather was Muslim as well, so I'm familiar.
So again, please understand, I'm fully open about my ignorance regarding this. Isa, is Muslim and Islamic the same belief systems, or is that kind of like Catholic and Lutheran, you know, Presbyterian and Methodist? I mean, are they just a derision of each other?
No, that's actually a good question, because I was completely ignorant also, and I think that this is just because of where we're raised, and we can equate that to political agenda or whatever that you know, unless you're a certain way, everything else is looked at as bad. But Islam is the name of the religion. Muslim is a person who practices the religion. So they are exactly the same. So Islam is the name of the religion. If you look at the word Islam, that's the word in Arabic, typically you add the prefix mu, M-U, to something, to a root word, to get the person who practices it. So if you listen closely, you can hear Islam. The person who practices it is a Muslim, you know. So hopefully that kind of makes sense.
Totally. I appreciate the insight on that. And I think, you know, again, this is good education for our listeners to see a different perspective of these stories in a different tale. So now I want to start getting into, and you know, talking about the jinn, that almost sounds like the demonic realm for Christianity. These powerful beings that, you know, kind of predate humanity. But the jinn, from my understanding, even in the Bible, seem to predate religion and predate gods and angels. How is that a good interpretation, or how would you explain that?
Well, I would explain it. Yes, they do. Yeah. So in the beginning, God obviously existed. The first thing he created out of the beings were the angels. The second thing were the jinn. And between the creation of jinn and humans, we don't know the exact time, but it could have been like hundreds of thousands of years or whatever, you know, however long old the universe versus or whatever, but it was a significant amount of time because the jinn had established societies and everything like that prior to the creation of man. So they do predate essentially everything in that regard.
Now, taking a look at the paranormal side of this and talking about, you know, what these spirits are, I guess I'm curious about one aspect of what the Islamic faith believes in. What happens to us when we die? Is there a heaven? Is there a hell? Is there a place for spirits to go? Or do we roam the earth, you know, with other places or other jobs to do before we can make that next leap to another evolution of existence?
Yeah, that's excellent. I was going to mention that too. This was something that I had was trying to reconcile prior to being Muslim. And that was this, like the concept, okay, of spirits. Like we seem to have, from a Christian perspective or any common ideology that we know in America and probably anyone who's listening to this, we view ghosts as the spirits of dead people who are having trouble passing on or passing over to the next state of existence or any variants of that. And or from another angle is that when someone immediately dies, they become an angel or something like this. We often hear this being said, and I don't mean this. I know this could be a touchy topic with some people, but I don't mean it in any kind of negative insulting way, but a lot of times people say, so-and-so's like heaven's got a new angel or so-and-so got their wings or something. And I even had issues with statements like this because from a Christian perspective, I'm like, well, what happened to the day of judgment or, you know, the rapture or all this? Like, so you just bypass all that and you became an angel today, you know? So these were things that, I'm sorry for laughing. I don't mean it to be insulting, but these were.
No, I gotcha.
You know what I mean? But these were things that were issues with me. So from the Islamic perspective, it answers that, you know, that question. So when we die, what happens? So we believe we have a spirit, right? So from an Islamic perspective, when you die, your spirit moves on to the next state of existence and cannot come back to earth, you know? And so I thought about this. And then I related that to things that we know and that I knew, like, because I was like, well, that kind of makes sense because you had these big people from our culture, like Houdini, for example, who said, if I can come back, I'm going to do it. And his wife tried for like 10 years, you know, and they could never, he never came back during the seance or anything. So it kind of started to fit.
Well, and
this.
That's weird too, right? Because there's been different iterations of that story. Some claim that she did finally get the message, but that she kept it private. And there are people that swear by that. And then there are others that say, you know, she just never came through. I know there's that famous recording of her. Oh, Hattie, tonight we will say our final goodbyes.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah,
and that, it's yeah, a great yeah. recording. But so there's been different stories regarding that. But we can't even get a solid state of affairs on how that story all unfolded.
Exactly. You know, so I had these things. And when I in Islam, when I heard that or learned this aspect, you know, I was like, well, that kind of makes sense because we have nothing. Everyone has experiences and can rationalize those experiences to being like, this was, you know, my dead relative or whatever, or so and so appeared to me the night that they died. And I'm not denying that that's what you experienced, or even if that is a possibility, but strictly now, as like from a, now we're talking kind of like a dogmatic thing, from an Islamic point of view, that can't happen. That wasn't what you saw. Now, what did you see? So now that goes into the realm of jinn. That's what you saw. So from the existence of a human being, from the Islamic point of view, we have assigned to us right now, you, Tim, me, we have an angel and a jinn assigned to us that always come are our companions throughout our whole life, recording our deeds. So this kind of ties into the good voice, the good angel, the bad angel, always whispering, you know what I mean? Those that kind of like ideology, you know, or these ideas that we heard since we were little, right, in cartoons, you know, you would see them and stuff.
Right. The good Bugs Bunny on one shoulder, the satanic
exactly,
one on the
yeah.
other. Right.
Exactly. You know, so we have this. This is what we believe. And so since the nature of a jinn is kind of a trickster, let me explain something to kind of, maybe this will connect listeners more. The word jinn is the plural. So when we speak about the race of beings, we say the jinn. A single jinn, the single word is Jinni, which obviously is bastardized into English as genie. So now you see like what the nature of these beings are, you know, like if we think of classical genie, like they're like weird. They like trick you. They do like, even if they're trying to help you, there's, you know, like you hear the saying, careful what you wish for, you know, cause you might get the wish, but there might be some weird thing, like, you know, like some weird thing that happens, or it's not exactly the way that you wanted the wish to come true, but you still got the wish, you know. So with that in mind, these are the beings that accompany us throughout our whole life as our companions. And so when we as humans die and pass on, we move to the next state of existence. The jinn also, jinn and angels also are going to die. I mean, they're not eternal beings. At some point they're going to die, but the lifespan of a jinn can stretch thousands of years. So when someone, like say at a seance, say if someone that I know dies, or someone that you know dies, or whomever, they're having a seance and they and an apparition appears, or they summon something, and they're, it's of a specific person, from the Islamic belief, what they summoned was that person's jinn companion. And since the jinn companion was with that person their whole life, they can have the attributes and seem like that person, and basically like trick the people into believing this, because ultimately then you're believing something other than like pure monotheism. You know what I mean? So the jinn, since they have free will, can be Jewish, Muslim, Christian, atheist, whatever. You know what I mean? So if they're bad guys, then they're going to try to trick you. Like if they're devils or evil spirits, they're going to try to trick you into misguiding you off of a path of monotheism. And so from this perspective, we believe that these apparitions that you see, that you might believe are someone you know or whatever, that's their jinn companion. And everybody has passed on. Once they die, they pass on to the next state of existence, which is kind, which in English we call like the state of the grave, which is where all the spirits are until the day of resurrection, which everyone will be judged. And then, yes, there's a concept of heaven, and the concept of hell also exists. On the day of resurrection, right, with, God would judge everyone. Yeah, go ahead.
With that said, I want to get into the idea of possession then. How does possession take place? And is it something we will, or that they have the will to take over on their own? We'll discuss that when we return. But first, it's time for a brand new Theater of the Mind.
Today's Theater of the Mind is an encounter shared by a listener who was wishing to remain anonymous. This is Footprints in the Snow. In the early 90s, the active duty left Grissom Force Base and turned it over to the Air Force Reserves. During the process, they simply walked away and left everything. One day, I was tasked to find a file cabinet. After a little searching, I found an old but in good condition file cabinet tucked away in a basement storage area. It was full of old command staff briefings from the early 80s. Most of the overheads were stats on readiness of the various organizations, but one caught my interest since it had an airfield diagram with some numbers and a line drawn across the runways and taxiways. The base was established hurriedly in the 1940s by the Navy at the outbreak of World War II, and even now, artifacts and unmapped infrastructure still get found. I started reading the briefing pages associated with the map, and this is the story that they told. Shortly after midnight on Wednesday morning, a driver from the snowplow team requested security to come to his location. Security forces arrived and the driver showed them tracks in the snow crossing the taxiway that he was plowing. Checking with the other drivers, and nobody left their cab on that night, and these were definitely footprints of what looked like a single person walked from the runway, crossing the taxiway, then into the infield, heading towards the base. Being a nuclear base, security scrambled, thinking someone was lost. An intruder, or possibly a plane unable to communicate, crashed unseen in the snowstorm. Visibility had been as low as a quarter mile in blowing snow, and the runway is over 2.5 miles long, plus two 1,000-foot overruns, and 400 feet wide shoulder to shoulder. The SPs were directed to follow the tracks toward the runway and find where they came from. The tracks went through the waist-high snow plowed from the runway and again on the other side of the runway, continuing south toward the perimeter fence. About 20 yards south from the end of the runway's paved shoulder, the tracks just started. It was noted that the tracks were filling with blowing snow, but still clearly visible. No other tracks or indications of a vehicle of any type were found. The base fence was still 200 yards to the south, and several hundred acres of snow-drifted farm field on the other side, and the nearest road was about 2 miles to the southeast. Another security team was dispatched to check the airfield perimeter fence. No vehicle or foot tracks on either side of the fence were found. Fencing and sensors were undisturbed, only snow drifting in the wind. Another security team followed the direction of the footprints into the infield and led to the base operations building, the only occupied and lighted building this time of night nearby. A sergeant from security forces noted that the prints were clearly visible from the infield, crossing the road onto the walkway and step leading to the base ops runway side entry door. No other footprints or vehicle tracks could be seen. Also noted the tracks were fresh enough to see that the treads were shallow and wavy like an aviator-style boot, not like a combat boot's deep, wide tread pattern. Inside, two personnel were on duty, the dispatcher and the weather observer. They claimed nobody at all had come in or out since they started at 2300 hours, and the log's last entry was just after 2100 hours when a local air crew returned from a training flight that evening and dropped off a paperwork package. Both of the operations personnel parked and entered from the base side of the building and wore muckluck boots coming in. Muckluck snow boots that have very deep and wide treads that go straight across the bottom of the boot. The airfield was closely monitored by stepped-up security all night and searched in the morning when the snow ended. No further footprints were found. No vehicles or people were found. The brief ended with, still under investigation.
Beyond the Darkness.
We're back. This is Beyond the Darkness. It's a fascinating guest, fascinating topic as we take a look at the supernatural from the Islamic state and belief system. Our guest, Issa Martel, is here to share with us this afternoon. We've heard some of the background, some of the ideas of what goes on. And comparatively, as I said, it sounds very similar to a lot of the belief systems in Christianity. Was that kind of a surprise to you to see that as well?
Yeah, it was. It was a surprise, but then, like I said, Islam, we believe in the essence of the Bible anyway, you know, so we believe all the people in the Bible were prophets, and the general events of the Bible took place, so logically it makes sense that there are these similarities and things in them, but I did find it surprising, and, you know, it was coming from that background of being Christian, it kind of also kind of made me be like, okay, this makes sense. Like, I viewed the Quran as part three of the whole thing. Like, the Old Testament was one part, the New Testament was part two, and then when I read the Quran, it was like part three and made the whole story complete then. I was like, all right, now this all makes sense.
So it's like the Star Wars trilogy. You just have to pick up each chapter.
Okay. Yeah, that's exactly it. Yeah.
So the spirit realm, they kind of exist around us at all times, according to the Islamic faith, correct?
Correct, yeah.
Okay, until that day of judgment and reckoning, which I think, you know, if you believe, most fundamentalist Christians believe that as well, that heaven and hell do not truly exist yet for those that have passed over until the day of reckoning, until the final judgment, and then souls will either ascend or descend, and that will be the time that there's a heaven and hell for us. So, you know, I find that an interesting aspect. But now talk to me about possession and hauntings. The ghosts or the spirits that haunt, are they always just the jinn characters that are doing this? Or is the belief that disembodied spirits do have the strength and ability to interact with the living?
Yeah, it's kind of, in a general sense, no, that the disembodied spirits don't have a way to interact with the living. We can, in there is like the idea that in your dreams this can happen, but in the sense of the physical world, no, it can't. In the world that we're living, I'm saying the physical world is our reality that we're in right now. It would be jinn, and there's a whole world generally spoke of as the world of the unseen, and it includes the jinn, but the jinn also have animals and other stuff with them, so it is a variant of different kind of spiritual beings that occupy it. So like hauntings, in a general sense, yes, we would say they're jinn. And to get into why would a jinn haunt something or this type of thing, characteristics of the jinn are typically that they like these abandoned places. They like spots that are dirty or abandoned. So these areas typically fulfill like desirable aspects that jinn like to be in. So in a haunted house, there can be, you know, 20 jinn, or however, there can just be one. When you get into concepts of like possession, would a jinn possess a human? It's possible. Yes, of course it is. We believe that. But it goes into like, typically there would be a reason why would a spirit want to possess you? It's not something that, is normal, you know? So it would kind of maybe deal with the person. The most general and typical reason is the fact that people have created some sort of talisman or charm or something like this that basically is attracting jinn to them. And by this, I mean, maybe it would have like a jinn's name written on it. They would go, there's these people that are essentially like magicians that would inscribe talismans that would have, if you read them or you looked at them, it would look like gibberish, but it might be like a series of names of jinn or something like this, or supposedly maybe written in their language. And they would roll it, like if it would be on a little piece of paper, they would roll it up and put it in a charm, and the person might wear this around their neck or however in their pocket or whatnot. And in, we don't really see this here in America because we're so, I don't want to say advanced, but we kind of have a separation from the all-encompassing spirituality of our nature, you know, due to science or whatever. So I feel that in our culture, we separate it, and most people tend not to believe in this stuff. But if you go to the Middle East or Africa countries, this is real, you know, and you see this a lot. So they would be charms that people wear. And then the reason the spirit would be attracted to this person is because slowly the person puts their faith in the actual talisman or charm to protect them, as opposed to having faith directly that God's going to protect them. So once that transfer begins to happen, you're then essentially giving the power, I guess, to the jinn whose name is written on that talisman to protect you, which would ultimately attract the jinn to you. And perhaps the jinn becomes attracted to you. And, you know, that's where things like this can cause possession to happen in that sense.
So it is something, again, that essentially needs to be called upon. But I think it's funny, right? In the Islamic faith, if I'm understanding this, you need like you're going steady. You're giving them a chain or a ring that's got their name inscribed on it. That's what calls them forward and binds you to these figures. How difficult is it then to break those bonds once the jinn or the evil spirits have been called upon? Once you've given entry to your life and your world, do they take a deep root?
Yeah, I guess they can, depending on how long that goes on. You know, like some people, they might not even know this. So it can be like, well, obviously they would know that they have the talisman or the charm or whatever they have, but they might not realize that over the course of years have been going by, and this bonding, like you said, has just grown stronger and stronger. So when something finally happens that makes them either self-aware that they might be possessed, or, you know, aware that something's amiss, that spirit could be like deeply ingrained in them. And then if they're going to have an exorcism at that point, these are like major, major events that happen. And it could be it could be like, for lack of a better word, like I mentioned before, it can be straight like The Exorcist, like the movie, you know, like it can be that level of, you know, they're trying to draw the demon out. It's very similar to that in that degree of severity.
All right. Now, do you, and you've actually assisted on a few exorcisms, and I want to get into that again and maybe in a few minutes here, but, in dealing with the paranormal and the belief of these different beings existing and coexisting, are there guidelines or belief systems regarding things of otherworldly nature, like Bigfoot, cryptids, UFOs and aliens, and how about mystical places? What are the basic takes on that?
The general answer to that is yes, that can all be believed in Islam. And clearly, since jinn are shapeshifters by nature. So they can, this is an excellent thing we can do real brief. They can appear as humans, as animals. Two of the favorite things that they appear as are snakes and black dogs. And so now check this out. When I had read this, you know what I instantly thought of was Son of Sam, who was like the neighbor's black dog was talking to me. You know, so this was another thing that like connected like a puzzle to me, you know, that made me like get more fascinated into this, you know, concept. So yes, if you're talking about Bigfoot and this like that, I mean, from my perspective, I mean, there could actually be a Bigfoot. I have no problem just like believing that an actual Bigfoot exists. But it could be also be like a shapeshifter, a djinn, these types of things. All these weird things that I don't want to say weird, because that could be viewed as a negative term. But all these types of things can fall under the category of it's a djinn, particularly with UFOs. So UFOs, clearly we describe a UFO as a djinn because in Islamic history and Islamic literature, the jinn had already developed technology to reach the heavens before humans were created. So it's clear then that if you have this technology, you know, perhaps what we're seeing now in the sense of a UFO could clearly be a jinn, you know, if you equated that pretty simply and quickly, you know.
Now, the again, jinn seem to be this really kind of unbelievable makeshift being that can kind of, it seems like, take on any visage it wants to. I know Rosemary Ellen Guiley has written quite a bit on the jinn, and for a while believes that you know, that most of what we experience is the jinn, just taking the form of aliens, Bigfoot, cryptids, black-eyed kids, whatever might be the creature du jour. So, you know, to me, it's just kind of an interesting aspect of it all.
Yeah, I would, that's kind of, I mean, I think she's right in that aspect. The only thing I kind of disagree with what she has to say is that I know, I don't know if she finished it, but I remember she was writing a book about the Arab Spring and saying that the jinn kind of like pushed this or something like that. And I kind of don't believe that. I think that that was just an event that happened. And I don't think that the jinn have the ability to control our world to that level of effect. You know, I think that they do, like we have the whispers of Shaitan, like Shaitan is the Arabic word for like Satans or the devils. And we have that word jinn, like evil, what we would call a demon or evil spirit, can whisper suggestions to you and cause you to do, you know, heinous acts or become evil or whatever. But to that level where they're controlling society on that degree, I just disagree with her in that aspect. But yes, to answer your question, it is kind of like a catch-all explanation to everything that's paranormal, you know.
Right, and seems to be, well, I mean, and if they are that powerful and kind of transcend history and time as these beings, it almost sounds too like in the naturalist and Native American culture, like the jinn might be eternals or elementals.
Yeah, exactly, and that's, you bring that up, and that kind of fits because there are classifications of jinn, and you know, we have like the classic example of like a genie. Like if we think of like a genie in a bottle or something like this, you think of like the elemental, like sand spirit coming up, you know, and the most powerful type of jinn, is a Marid, which can easily fit that classification of an elemental or a massive demonic presence, like the Balrog or something like this from Lord of the Rings. You know, this can easily fit into that category.
Well, let's do this. Let's talk about possession and exorcism in the Islamic faith. Welcome back. This is Beyond the Darkness. And today we're taking a unique perspective and look at different faiths and belief systems on the supernatural, the paranormal, something like possession and exorcism, which is originally what had you reach out to me. What about the show and topics that we've covered like this made you feel that, you know, this was the point you wanted to reach out and offer to chat with us about this?
I think it just happened to be timing that you mentioned that one comment and about the documentary about the Exorcist, or not the Exorcist, the movie, whatever that documentary was. And
Devil and Father Amworth.
Yeah, and I just happened to be like looking at Twitter at that moment, and you know, coincidentally was like, yeah, what about this? But I had been listening to you guys since you were on just the 1 hour slot, you know, from 11 to midnight back in the day. And, you know, I had been thinking about it for a while. And like I said, it just happened to be that moment that did it, you know.
Well, let's get into this aspect of it. And at what point did you start to study and look into that? Was it something that drew you into, you know, I wonder how they deal with possession and how do we exorcise a spirit in this way? And then talk to me about that. You've been a part of a couple of exorcisms with some people that you've known and have been called in to aid in this. Talk to us about, you know, again, the genesis of how you studied this and what got you involved into the calling of actually hands-on involvement in an exorcism.
Yeah, so I had, I lived for 3 years in Morocco. So when I was there, I was a backpacking guide, so I had traveled a lot into the mountains and the desert while I was there, and this is kind of where I became more in tune deeply with these concepts in Islam, because you would see them, you would see in practice people more living their life in a naturalistic, spiritual type of way. And so there's this place, the first time I had seen an exorcism was in Morocco. So I had heard about them a lot. I had heard some tapes and some lectures that talked about Muslims that did exorcisms in Philly, but I had never seen one. So I was in Morocco at the time, and there's this place called Sidi Chemerouche, which is the last village on the way to the highest peak in North Africa in the High Atlas Mountains. The peak is called Mount Tubkal. And if you're trekking up to this peak, you have to go through this little village. So in this village, there's this, like a shrine, essentially. And the shrine is dedicated to the king of the jinn, of the tribe of jinn that live in these mountains. So I thought this was fascinating. I had gone up to this place numerous of times because I had hiked this trail a lot with different groups that I was with. And one time there was a Malaysian woman in my group. And there's a point in this village where there's a sign that says only Muslims could actually go into the shrine. So she happened to be Malaysian. She was Muslim. And I was like, you want to go check out the shrine? I'll take you up to it. So she was like, yeah, it'd be kind of interesting. So we go into this shrine, and here they're about to do an exorcism. So inside the shrine, to try to give you a description, if you Google it, you can see a picture of it. But to give you a description, it's a square building, but one wall of the building is a giant boulder. And then there's like three other walls that make the room, and they're like concrete rooms. It has a flat roof, and the one wall is this giant boulder. Under this boulder in the room is like a grave, which is the shrine, I guess, part of it. There's a lot of stories behind this shrine, that originally what happened was a woman couldn't get pregnant. She went up to this area, prayed to the king of the jinn, got pregnant. Now they sell like water, like would be like the holy water from the spring and stuff they sell at this place. But in any case, we go in this shrine and there's a bunch of guys sitting in there with drums, and they have a table with a bunch of tea and like dates and stuff on this table. And then there was a woman who was up kind of closer to the boulder, and there were candles lit around her and stuff. And I came in with this Malaysian woman, and we were like, wow, you know, I guess it's about to go down. And they said, yeah, why don't you sit and join us? So they had the Malaysian woman sit up by the woman who was possessed. And then it was like a couple women were up there by her. And then all the guys with the drums and everything were behind them, but we were all in the room. So they start drumming, right? And it's like some tribalistic drumming experience, and then they start chanting. And it was kind of dark in this room, and especially where the woman who was possessed is, but there were candles by her. So this drumming starts going on, and they start chanting. They're chanting in Arabic, and they had like photocopied papers of what they were chanting. So if you wanted to join in and to read it, you can do it too. And this woman started coughing like a deep, like something is like, it sounded like something was really deep in the back of her throat, a dry, heavy cough. She starts coughing, and I'm like, oh man, this is getting crazy now. So then she started like contorting, and this was maybe about like 10 minutes into this experience, and I'm watching her. And her, at this point, it seemed like the drumming was at like a feverish pitch, and like the whole sensory experience was like extremely heightened and like very trance-like. And I look at this woman's face, and it starts contorting in an unnatural way. The best way I could explain it, as if you ever, when you look at like the ground, if it's real hot and you see the heat radiating off the asphalt, you know, it's like blurs, whatever's behind it. It looked like that heat was in front of her face. So her face was like distorting and everything like that looked like that. I was so disturbed at this that I left. And I left, unfortunately, that Malaysian woman sitting up in the front because I couldn't get to her. But I thought that my head went back to that moment in The Exorcist when the demon jumps out of her into the priest. That's what was going on in my mind at that point, and I left the exorcism. I walked out. I was like, no, this is way too intense for me to be a part of. And a couple minutes later, the Malaysian woman came out and said, I turned around and you weren't there. And she was equally as like moved by it and disturbed. I asked the Malaysian woman, I said, what happened then? And she said she kept coughing and everything. And then like, she seemed to stop contorting and become normal, and like the drumming and everything stopped. And then we saw a few minutes later, the woman actually come out, and she seemed perfectly fine and normal like that. So that was my first experience where I really, I'll say like witnessed something that was extremely paranormal and moved me to the point that like, all right, this is like beyond anything I've ever experienced and seen in my life.
And then, you know, was this something that you felt called to, you know, educate more? So if you ever did encounter somebody in this position again, that might be possessed, that there was something that you could be more adept at doing?
Yeah, because I felt that, you know what, if I believe this, which I do, and I did at the time, if I believe that this whole world concept and worldview that's predicated according to Islam, which that this spirit world exists, I need to know how to do all this stuff to protect myself. At this point, I wasn't married and I didn't have kids when this happened, but my nature is I need to know how to deal with this. Since now I'm having confirmation in my experience that this is real, even though I believed it was real before, now it's like, all right, yep, that moment solidified it for me. I need to know how to prevent that. If I ever come into that position, I need to know how to deal with that situation. And that's kind of my nature, is that, all right, I want to know, I want to be able to do all this stuff because of that, to protect the, you know, myself, my family, anyone I know, because I believe it was real now, you know, even though I did before, but it was kind of like the validation of, okay, this is a real thing. So it was that point that kind of drew me into really researching more into this aspect of spirituality, like exorcism and demon possession and this whole realm.
Yeah. Understandable. That's remarkable. And yeah. And that's what I would think, you know, seeing something like that, I would love to know what I could do to be involved in that if we run across it again. But once you've seen something like that, I mean, if somebody asked you for help again, would you be willing to jump in, you know, feet first? Or is it something that, you know, I don't know, maybe I'll just give you the phone number of a guy I know?
Yeah, I mean, by nature, I would be like, yeah, you know what, I would help, you know. And eventually that's what happened, which we can talk about next, is when I moved back here to, came back from the Morocco, I moved here to Minnesota. That's eventually what happened. And I started to do that. But initially, I am trepidatious always initially, because that event was so moving, and it was kind of like, you know, you obviously, you've been on many different things and experienced a lot, but you can relate to that moment of, am I spiritually strong enough to deal with what this person, what's about to happen? What if it goes completely like haywire? Am I screwed? Or, you know what I mean? Like, what's going to go on? You know? So yes, I am trepidatious about it. But if someone was to ever call me, and they did, I had other people call me now that I'm here and word got out. People do call me, and I'm kind of known in our area where we live here in Minneapolis as like the guy to call if you have like some gin issue or a question about magic or just something weird.
Does that happen often in Minneapolis that you need calls on the gin?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say often, but it has happened. So, you know, amongst the Muslims, I mean, obviously it's weird because amongst Muslims, this is still something that is unfortunately viewed as bad, like a negative thing. Like if this is happening to you, you've done something bad or you're a bad Muslim or whatever. And that's clearly not the case, you know, but it's still here in Minneapolis, our Muslim population is a lot of immigrants and Somalis and stuff. So they bring that cultural baggage to here. So that it's like in those cultures, it's viewed as very bad, which I'm not saying it's good if you're possessed by a demon or to deal in magic. I would say, no, this is all stuff you shouldn't do. But at the same time, it is part of the religion. And it's something that Prophet Muhammad did, Jesus did. Like, all it's documented that these people cast out demons and spirits. So in wanting to fully encompass this, you know, I am the type of person that, look, I need to know how to do it, you know. So that's what led it here. So here, there was an incident I can tell you. Someone I knew that was pretty close to us, they had this event start happening to them. So what happened was, it was the middle of winter, and I got a call. I was working at the time, so they called me and left a message that there was a bat inside their house. And I was like, okay, that's weird. Well, it's winter. Bats should be hibernating. How did it get in the house? What's going on, you know? And the person had told me that must have came through a crack. They like in the corner of the basement, the basement's a furnished basement with a gas fireplace and there's like a gas line. So maybe it came through there. That's only need like a quarter inch or a half inch of space to get into something. So I was like, that is weird. That's possible. But the weird thing was that this bat was like kind of attacking this person. And, the person who it was attacking was, literally like hiding under blankets, and the bat was like dive bombing them and like basically like headbutting them to the point where the person has bruises. And I got pictures of the bruises and everything. I'll send them to you. But it was like serious. Like it was serious, like this bat going out of control. So, you know, like I was like, well, is the bat, does it have rabies or something weird? But it just seemed off. And so what they did was like kind of quarantine the area. And this was witnessed by this woman, the woman's kid, and her friend. So it wasn't just one person witnessing this. So it was a group of people, and they were all like paranoid in hiding, but this bat just kept circling the room and dive bombing them. So they kind of quarantined the area, and the bat, by the time I got there after work, the bat had went back into the wall, and I heard it between the floors, like in the subfloor. Like it was, we were on the finished basement. So in the floor between the basement and the ground floor, you can hear the bat crawling and making like the bat, you know, the bat sounds in the like subfloor. So I was like, all right, this is like definitely weird. And so I had, was at this point, I was like, all right, well, it's out of here. I had on my phone, I have like the Quran, the whole Quran recited on my phone. So I started playing the Quran, like in Arabic, the recitation, and pushing it and aiming it at the bat, like where it was in the subfloor, to see if that, in my head, it was like, okay, this might be something, you know? So I was doing that. The sound, the bat seemed to like disappear or something and go away. And that was it for that night. So we couldn't find it or anything. So I was like, all right, well, it's gone. I don't know where, maybe it flew out of the house, however it came in or whatever. So that was that for that night. The next night, what happened the next day was that the kid, the woman, one of the woman's children, had came in the bedroom in the morning and was talking to her. And she was like, hop in the bed with me. And the kid, who was probably like six at the time, said, I would, but I don't like that thing on your head. And the woman was like, what are you talking about? And here the bat was sleeping on her head. And when she looked like sat up, jeez, the bat like got startled and swooped out of the bedroom and went all the way back in like one glide, maybe flapped once, went all the way back down to the basement to where it was, you know? So at this moment, she was like, that gotta be something, you know, that was like completely insane. This gotta be something. So I came back, in the interim that day when I was at work that day, the bat, she had her kid, trying to lure it out, and they were trying to get it out of the house, but it did the same thing, dive bomber. At one point, it like mounted and stood on its hind legs on the mantle of the fireplace, like spreading its wings and hissing at like the kid and like her. And it's like, all this is an abnormal behavior for a bat in the middle of the winter, you know, like to be in your house. So it was kind of like extremely frightening. So I got there, the bat is circling the room. So my initial thing was like, all right, let's try to get this bat out of the house. They had a sliding door. We got the bat out of the house, and it's like the glass, the door's glass screen, like a glass screen door. the bat is sitting outside by the light, on the outside light, about like 6 inches from the door. But it wouldn't go anywhere. So I told the kid, who was maybe like 14 or something, I was like, hold the door shut, and I'm going to get a piece of cardboard and slide it through the crack of the door so we can like hit the bat and make it fly. What happened here was, it was another event of unexplainable. What happened here was that I got the cardboard and I looked back up and the bat was inside the house again. So I was like, did you open the door? How did it get in? And he was like, no, I don't know how it got in. It just is in again. And it went through the glass. So, I mean, I don't know how that happened, but it was clearly like freaked everyone out. The kid had a little pellet gun, a pellet rifle. So I was like, get your pellet rifle. We're just going to shoot this bat right there. So the bat was flying around the house. It mounted itself on the wall, like bats do. It clung to the wall. I kind of shined a spotlight at it, and I told the kid, I was like, take the shot at the bat now. The kid shot it, hit it. The bat fell down to the ground. Obviously, it was dead. It was a small bat, but I didn't want to take that. I mean, it sounds completely insane. I know it's not insane to anyone listening, to any of the viewership. It's probably not insane, but if you're telling
it's insane.
This, like, you know, if you're telling this to anyone, it's crazy. So I was like, yo, we're not messing around. We went out, dug the fire pit out of like the 3 feet of Minnesota snow, burned that thing, the corpse and everything, in the middle of the night in winter. So that was that experience. But from that, then I performed an exorcism on the woman. So when I performed the exorcism on the woman, which happened like the next day, I did the whole, she didn't have any of these talismans or anything like that, so that wasn't an issue. But what we do for the exorcism is similar to what you would think about in like Catholicism. We recite certain verses of the Quran over the person. There's some things they could do, like things that, like black seed oil, and you can rub in the person's hair that can break up any magic or anything that would be put on them. They can drink olive oil, eat dates. There's certain foods and stuff, and kind of like preparations and things that can negate if there is like something like the evil eye was put on this person or whatever, to help kind of release that. So I'm reciting these verses and stuff to her, and she starts to do this coughing, and the coughing sounded like, it brought me back to that point in Morocco. And this was now like probably like 7 or 8 years later, but it reminded me of that sound that the woman made in Morocco. So this woman, she starts coughing, and she's like saying like, get it out of my mouth, get it out of my mouth. And she's saying like, she's like spitting and saying it tastes like coal and charcoal in my throat and in my mouth. And she's spitting. She's saying, don't you smell that? Don't you smell that? I smell the smoke. And you know, like, this is what's going on. So I just kept reciting. The process is called like Rukia. That was what you're doing. It's basically, like I said, reciting Quran and certain other prayers, I guess, over this person. At this point, this stuff seemed to come out of her. And she seemed to go back to normal and relax and be like in a more peaceful state and calm demeanor. I viewed it in that situation, just to be brief, I viewed that as, okay, that was successful in dealing with what that had happened at that time period. So that's like a quick exorcism story, I guess, for you there, but it is pretty wild at that.
Very wild. I know you've got to get going again, Issa Martel, our guest. I want to thank you for calling up and being willing to share a different perspective and viewpoint and kind of educating us on this. I think it's been enlightening on many different levels today to hear from you. So thank you for doing that and being a part of the show.
Yeah, no problem. And anytime, you know, if you want to keep going at it or whatever, feel free to give me a call or whatever. I'll be glad to talk about anything in this,
thank
in
you.
This field. Yeah.
I appreciate that. Issa Martell, our guest, and I want to thank all of you for tuning in and making us part of your week. We'll be back again next weekend with more of the best in Paranormal Talk Radio. And remember, you can continue your journey into the strange and unusual with me Monday through Friday on Midnight in the Desert. You can find all the information on ways to listen at midnightinthedesert.com. Well, Tim, another week come and gone. Man, they're going by quick, aren't they?
Yes, they are.
Hey, speaking of, we're going to be out in just a few weeks at the Michigan Paracon in Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan. There are some tickets still available. An amazing lineup of speakers, people like Nick Groff and Katrina Weidman from Ghost Adventures and Paranormal Lockdown. I know that they've just added Josh Gates will be a part of the lineup. I think Grant Wilson is going to be there from Ghost Hunters and so many other speakers. Tim and I will be on hand. You can get all the information by going to darknessradio.com and click on the events tab. That's darknessradio.com. Click on the events tab to find that and all the other ways that you can see us and meet us throughout the year. All right, sir. It's been fun. Thanks a lot for being here, Tim.
Thank you.
We will be back again next week with more of the best in Paranormal Talk Radio. This is Beyond the Darkness.
If you've been thinking about getting serious with your money, like actually serious, now's the time. The Motley Fool is offering new members 50% off their iconic stock recommendation service, Stock Advisor. This is the same service that's crushed the market with recommendations that have returned 1,057% since inception, compared to the S&P 500's 180% over that same period. This isn't guesswork. The Motley Fool has a track record of finding companies before they become household names. So if you want to invest smarter and you like saving money while doing it, go to fool.com/listen to claim your 50% off discount off a 1-year term of Stock Advisor. Again, that's fool.com/listen. Returns of 1,057% are from the Motley Fool's product Stock Advisor and measured against S&P 500 returns of 180% as of July 10th, 2025. Past performance is not an indicator of future results. All investing involves a risk of loss. Individual investment results may vary.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.